Is America becoming a nation of rootless, digitized wanderers? Can a culture flourish without a firm sense of place? Well, we're going to talk right now with an author who's also a history professor at Oklahoma University, and he has co-authored a book or co-edited a book called Why Place Matters, Geography, Identity, and Civic Life in Modern America. His name is Dr. Bill McClay. Dr. McClay, welcome.
Hi, it's good to meet you and good to talk with you.
Sure. So let me ask you a question. And by the way, I understand you're part of the Trinity Forum, which I know for years, Oz Guinness, who I've interviewed many times, and I really appreciate him. He's basically the founding senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. So your particular perspective is a Christian one. And so explain this book. What is this book all about? I know it's not directly Christian in the same way as your worldview is, but what's the point of the book?
Well, I think the book, I have to sort of explain this by telling a story, because the book is something that kind of emerged out of a process. I was a visiting professor at Pepperdine in the School of Public Policy there, which is a very unusual School of Public Policy in that they take matters of the faith in the humanities more seriously than nearly all the others do.
When you were a professor there, who was the president?
I think it was Andy Benton, who is the president now.
Okay, all right.
You know, I was there for just a year as a visiting professor. But when I arrived on campus, they sort of said, well, you know, we'd really love it if you would put on a conference during your year here or organize one. And I said, well, what do you want it to be about? And they said, well, whatever you want. So this was proposed to me at a lunch when we were sitting in a beautiful, one of these California settings that's just unparalleled, you know, in a canyon near Pepperdine, but over, you know, overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and
and I
said, what about the significance of place in human existence? You know, of where we are placed, of how much do we derive from that, and by the same token, to what extent are we, you know, citizens of the world, whose relationship to the place of our birth and all of that is transient in character. And so it evolved into a colleague and I, Ted McAllister, who's the co-editor of the book, put together a very nice, if I do say so, conference on this subject. It was called A Place in the World. And we really were trying to deal with the tension between the fact that we are ultimately part of a particular place, and that's where our commitments lie, that's where our families are, that's where our communities are, and so on, but that we also have this ever-growing sense of interconnection with the rest of the world, and to think about how to negotiate that. And I think you could, in a way, we never thought of it this way, but that in a way what we were beginning to formulate is a kind of critique of the flat world idea, the Thomas Friedman notion that all the sort of barriers that separated and hierarchies that characterized the world of the past have been obliterated by the digital revolution and by, you know, the rapid communications and open boundaries and so on and so forth, free trade. And so we're kind of pushing back against that. We're pushing back against cosmopolitanism. We're pushing back against the idea of being a citizen of the world. And in fact, the conference was so good, so interesting, so lively, that we started thinking about preserving it in book form, and so that's what we've done, and we solicited a few other contributions, but there are, I think, 16 essays in the book, and they're by a wide variety of very distinguished writers, including one of my favorites, although it's a different perspective of mine, is an essay by Dana Gioia, a poet, who it's titled, I Can't Believe You're From L.A., and part of what he's trying to push back against, is the idea that L.A., Los Angeles, is a community of rootless people who just spend their lives on the freeway and have no attachment to anything. That in fact, people are much more rooted, even in L.A., than they think they are. And I think if there's one of the messages that we hope will come out of the book is that people should be more conscious of these things, be more willing to be consciously committed to being citizens of the place in which they find themselves, to speak in somewhat more Christian terms, to be good stewards of the places they find themselves in, to invest themselves heart and soul in those places, not as ends in themselves, because I think as Christians we don't make a fetish out of this world. We know that this world is a provisional good, and we're on the way to a greater good. But it is a good. It is a good of God's creation, and it deserves our very best. And we can't give it that if we are constantly on the move and don't identify ourselves with any particular locality. You know, the famous Diogenes, Diogenes the Cynic, who went around with a lantern looking for an honest man. He's really the godfather of cosmopolitanism. And he is alleged to have said, when asked, what city-state are you a citizen of? And he says, I am a citizen of the world. And that's what cosmopolitanism means, literally, to be a politan of the cosmos, of the world. A cynical way of looking at Diogenes the Cynic would be to say this is a way of getting off the hook for having any obligations to particular places, the places where we are as individuals, where our families are, where our roots are, where we draw our nourishment and sustenance. And if I could say also, and please interrupt me if there's something that I'm passing over that you think is important that I'm just not dealing with adequately, but there is an element in this that's profoundly Christian, and that is that at the heart of the Christian faith, and something that a lot of people stumble over, is this thing that theologians call the scandal of particularity. That is that Christ appeared in human history, in the stream of human history, and his message, the thing he offers, is universal in character, but he was a particular person. He was a Jew in a particular time and place, and I think some people would like to have, you know, multiple Jesuses, you know, a Jesus for this place and this time. And no, that's not the way interventions into history are. They are particular in character, and so we owe a loyalty. We come to the universal through the particular. I think that's part of the Christian, particularly. In thinking of the life of Jesus, but also for us more in a more general way. We don't necessarily come to the universal by eschewing the particular, by rejecting this world or treating it as if everything in it was fungible, replaceable by something else, in some way it's right that we, for example, take our own children as being more of a source of responsibility to us than other people's children. And that's just common sense in a way, but, you know, sometimes people wonder, well, does the doctrine of universal love require us to love all equally? No, I don't think it does. I mean, it's certainly not in the same way.
Well, that's so true. Just take the example of education. The children where the parents really care about their children's education, those children excel Mm-hmm. Whether it's in the public school, whether those children are in a private school, or let's say a Christian school, or even homeschooled, even there is even more so that the parents are the ones teaching them. And so, therefore, the children do so much better. Now, as far as society itself, not only are we rootless today and people move around a lot and so forth, but you also have such a breakdown of the family. You have the throwaway society, and so you have a lot of throwaway marriages and so forth. So we have a lot of people who are kind of almost like nomads, but not only rootless in terms of place, but rootless in terms of family structure.
Yeah, and I think the digital revolution has been very threatening to all of that. I don't know that.
What do you mean by the digital revolution? You mean another Facebook? Or what do you mean?
Yes, I mean even going back to things like the cell phone, which it has an interesting role in terms of the concept of place. But you think of how for particularly young people who grow up saturated in this stuff, and who talk about websites as if they are places, go to this and that, you know. And who say when they say that they've been talking to someone, they mean they've been carrying on a back and forth online, which is actually a very different thing from a face to face conversation. But they're so immersed in social media, in a sort of online presence. And this is not even to get into things like Second Life, but just the more ordinary Facebook, Twitter, you know, that kind of thing. And now those are actually old hat. I mean, the things that kids are doing now are different from those. But they get so absorbed in those things that they're not rooted in the sort of physical world around them. They're not opening their eyes.
Yeah.
To not just their families, but even to the tree in the front yard, the
yeah.
street, the
yeah,
and of course at a certain point you do have to deal with the reality of those things.
Yeah, and another thing too is that people are very lonely, and a recent study came out and found that people who are lonely tend to die earlier. In fact, I wrote a column about it, and mm-hmm. I talked about mm-hmm. how. You know, I've often wondered why is it that statistics show over and over and over in, you know, compiled over years and so forth from different studies that people who attend church on a regular basis tend to live longer. And I said, I you know, wonder why that is. Now, meanwhile, here's a study which shows that people who are lonely die earlier, you know, than average. And I said, well, let's put those two together. Maybe going to church helps people provides them with a community of believers, and that helps alleviate loneliness. Just kind of combining those two. And so Christ is part
Absolutely.
Of the answer in that sense.
Absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, sort of online, one of the many reasons why an online, church kind of entity isn't really a church entity. There's reason why getting your body out of bed on Sunday morning and into a pew, even if you have to force yourself, as you know, I often feel that way. You know, like, well, just Lord, just this week, couldn't I just sleep in? And but it's almost always such a good thing to actually show up, and the others who show up. You know, I don't mean to trivialize worship. But that's one element in it. Is it certainly to gather together, which is one of the things that the Lord calls us to do. You know, we are not supposed to be believers by ourselves. We're supposed to gather.
Sure.
Together, and it's not surprising to me that something that we're commanded to do would turn out to be good for us.
Sure.
And. Even if we're not given all the reasons at the time why it's good for us, but
okay.
I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Sure, And now, for those who may have just joined us, we're talking right now with Dr. McClay, who is co-editor of a book called Why Place Matters. It's an encounter books, which is very impressive. The subtitle is Geography, Identity, and Civic Life in Modern America. What were you going
to
say?
And may I also mention to members of your audience who would like to learn more about the book or to get a copy,
yes,
that they can simply go to a website called whyplacematters.com and find out whatever they want about ordering it. So, and it's available through Amazon and
sure,
all those kinds of digital,
digital
providers.
Now, okay, now, speaking of digital providers and so forth, I remember this, and I'll never forget this, I don't think, ever, where I saw in a restaurant three members of a family, a mother and her son, presumably, and her daughter. And they were all sitting there, all at the same table, all at the same time, and they were all looking independent. They were not talking with each other.
Yeah.
Each of them was looking at their own little iPod or iPhone or whatever, iTouch, and just clicking away or whatever, just reading away. And it's like, wow, how does that work? And they were like that in that restaurant for a period of time. There was no human interaction, even though they were together. They could just as well have been 3,000 miles apart from each other.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, this reminds me, I have a friend from church who is the wife of a very distinguished attorney in these parts, and very successful, and she's, you know, quite socially prominent and so on. But she was telling me, look, when I get together for lunch when we get together with our friends, we all put our smartphones, cell phones, whatever, in the middle of the table and turn them off.
Oh, good. Hey, that's a great idea.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is an older person, and maybe those of us who are a little bit older can see, in the way that the young can't, the damage that this can do to your relationships when you don't simply have the discipline to put down this instrument of technology, which, after all, people can use as a wall. It's a way of, may or may not have been in that instance you just described, but it could have been a way that all three of them were avoiding having to talk to one another, which is there's always friction in dealing with other people, you
sure,
know, because they have needs and wants and desires that you have to attend to that may be different from yours. And, you know, and it's part of the whole negotiation, the way that we, that ideally iron sharpens iron in the relationships we have as human beings, that we are accountable to one another. Some of that is lost when you're dealing with three people who are staring into their sort of private fantasy world instead of being together.
Sure.
And experiencing all that can do, including, you know, it can be a little bit more challenging to really be together rather than be in what in fact is a sort of frictionless world that is, unless your computer isn't working.
Your life is a crisis of the first order.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but ultimately, the point of your book, in part, is geography, place,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet, okay. When I think of the Bible, I think of the situation where you definitely have situations where people, by God's commands in many different cases, are caused, or, you know, by obeying him, they are moving away. So, for example,
Abraham,
you know, exactly. First one that comes to mind. And then,
yes,
of course, later the Hebrews ended up in Egypt. And at first it was great. And then later it didn't work out well at all. And they became slaves. And then they wander around the desert. And then, you know, so forth. But comment about that, the geography in the Bible,
well,
in that sense.
I think, and look, there's another example that comes to my mind, and that is that, and this could stand for a lot of ways in which Christianity elaborates upon and deepens and changes the nature of Judaism, but, you know, there's the changing role of the temple, of what the temple was you know, there was a physical temple that
right.
destroyed. And Jesus, when he speaks of the temple of himself being destroyed and raised again, he's talking about a different temple, and he's pointing to the fact that there's no specific earthly place where God will in some way be located, but we've made a move into a different level of
right. And then Paul goes on to say that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
So each believer has the Holy Spirit abiding.
So it's another way that it's delocalized, if you will.
Yeah.
And so there are these tensions. I think it goes back to, I think the concept of stewardship is very helpful here because, we do need because of our fragile, vulnerable natures, our sinful natures. We do need to have, and we're called to have particular associations, affiliations, and actually the fact that God may call us to from one place to another. You know, if a pastor may be perfectly happy at one place in the beautiful. Coral Gables, a beautiful place, and say, well, you know, we're calling you to, the most remote part of Wyoming, or Alaska, or or the middle of Australia, some dreary place, and well, you know, you don't necessarily refuse that call just because you're so attached to the place, and the place is so attachment worthy. But when you go to the other place, you are fully there. You know that's part of the point that we're making is that
when you're there, be there.
When you're there, be there.
Yeah,
completely.
Don't be somewhere else.
Yeah, don't be somewhere else. And part of what comes across in a number of the contributors to our book is a sort of the placelessness is different from mobility. Mobility, we do have a very mobile society, and I think, you know, sometimes think we're maybe too mobile, that we move too much, that we move
Well, let me ask you this. Are you from Oklahoma?
No, I'm not. I'm a good example.
Where are you from?
I'm from Maryland, and I grew up in Maryland, got all my formal education there. But since I've been in the professor biz, I've spent 12 years at Tulane University in New Orleans.
Oh, I went to Tulane. I got my BA at Tulane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The 1970s, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was there in mostly the 90s.
Okay.
And then I came to the University of Tennessee. And was there for 14 years, and now I'm at Oklahoma. I mean, really just finished my first year here.
Wow. Now, through it all, through all those different moves and so forth, you probably feel like God led you along the line. So part of God's leading includes getting up and moving in some context. So that's not what you're, in a sense, speaking against.
No, it's not. And in fact, there is that, I think... You know, the danger, and I think if we do a sequel to this, so this is an issue we'd like to address, is it the danger is making an idol of place, frankly, non-attachment to any place is, there's something wrong with that. It's denying our corporeality. It's denying our createdness. It's denying the good fruits of God's work. But an excessive attachment to place is just as bad.
Right, I see.
It doesn't recognize that our place, our bodies, our earthly existence is all part and parcel of what we're made to be. The example of marriage is one that I find particularly poignant in this. You know, as my wife and I both, we're blessed with it. Extremely happy marriage, and we often say the only thing we don't like about the Christian faith is that we won't be married in heaven. You know, and although I mean I'm not uh, I'm not.
I know.
I don't want to delve into the theology of that, but that there are some kinds of to say that marriage between a man and a woman in this life for their entire lives till death parts them is a very high value, that it's central to the way in which we think of the structure of the Christian family and of Christian nurture and so on, is not to say that it is in some sense an ultimate value. It actually points toward, as in Ephesians, you know, it points toward the relationship of Christ and the church. And in the same way that I think about being a father, which I am, very early on I realized that in some way my role in life was to model for my children God's nature and be willing to yield to the real Father when they were able to, through me, and sometimes occasionally in spite of me, be able to see the characteristics of God the Father model in however, you know, inadequate and tentative a way, broken a way in me.
Sure.
So I think there's some, you know, some parallels there in the way we think about our places, our places of habitation, you know, and maybe even our churches, the buildings in which we house worship. I think we've given too little attention in this country to the architecture of churches and to the notion of...
That's a good point.
What does it mean to set aside a church as a sacred space?
Yeah, not, you know, it's funny. You look at all the churches today that are almost like warehouses. And then when somebody within that church wants to get married, where do they go? Oh, well, let's see. Is the Episcopal church on the street? That's beautiful.
Right, exactly, the Episcopal church. Or, the you know, some cathedral.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And it does reflect something important, I think, that we...
Oh, yes. I agree. Well, you know, God is the source of all beauty and light, and he made us as creative beings and so forth. We only have a couple minutes left. Does the average person in America... move? Do you have any statistics on that by chance?
I don't. Not at my fingertips. I mean, I think I think it's not uncommon for people to move four or five times over the course of their life. But sometimes those moves are very small moves, like to the other side of town, or
right. Oh, okay.
or something like that. But you know, if I may say, I taught it for a little while in Italy, and and I was struck by the difference between Italian young people and American young people in this regard. That they, and there's survey data to this effect, that they, for an Italian, the ideal job is something that's within 50 kilometers of where they were born, and the overwhelming majority of Italian young people do live within 50 kilometers of where they were born. This is certainly not true in America, and I think in America we rightly or wrongly regard that kind of attitude as would regard it as a little unhealthy. You want to move away from Akron? What's wrong with Akron? You know, or wherever, you know, Dallas, Sacramento. There's a sense that it's sort of right that people should kind of take off and make their own lives, and actually this is, as you know quite biblical, that you know, when a marriage takes place, there's a kind of leaving.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's true. All right, we have about 1 minute left, even less than that. Is there any concluding you thought you want to have? Again, the name of the book is Why Place Matters, whyplacematters.com for more information.
Yeah.
Dr. Bill McClay.
It's Wilfred McClay, and that's the name that I publish under. But I would just say that I think what we're looking for in this book is not a kind of obsession with place as the center and core of all things, but to regain a kind of balance that we've lost between what is made possible by globalization, by digitization, by this sort of movement, freedom of movement, freedom from place,
right,
that that characterized the modern world, to some sort of, you know, deeper sense of our embodiment, our creatureliness, of the finite conditions of for which we were made,
sure,
and that it would to embrace those things.
All right. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. God bless you.
My pleasure.
And again, Why Place Matters is the name of the book, whyplacematters.com for more information. All the best to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. God bless.